what I want to do is read from the Bible very, very quickly before we do anything else. And I'm just going to read you something from Corinthians, the beginning of the first letter Paul wrote to the Corinthians. starting in verse 18, so chapter 1 and verse 18. And some of the sessions we've had before now, we've been kind of darting in and out of the Bible quite a lot. That's not my plan tonight. But what I hope is that if you've got questions during the course of this evening, you can just ask them. And if they refer us to the Bible and they want to tackle something in the Bible, just raise the question and we'll take it like that, okay? I was going to read just that this passage that Paul writes about Christ, the wisdom and power of God. I'm reading in the ESV only because I happen to have it in front of me, but it's very similar to what you have in the NIV. Verse 18, the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who's wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand a sign, Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Let me just begin tonight by asking you a question. I'm not going to pepper you with questions this evening, but I will just ask you once or twice, just one or two little things as we go along. There's the question, the big story. What really are the main events of the Bible? Just going to write something down before we start and go any further. Just put it down here. What do you think? Creation. Thank you. Fall, Exodus, flood, yeah, the law, yeah, the old pen, huh? Running out of steam, got to the law, it's only the second book of the Bible, huh? Give me your highlights. I just want a sort of a very edited 2-minute highlight. Somebody says, "What are the big events of the Bible to you?" This is what you call the elevator pitch. You know, you're in an elevator going up the top floor. They say, "What's the Bible about? What are the big stories of the Bible?" You go, "Bang, bang, bang." What do you say? So David and Saul. David's like the kings. Yep. Land. Yes, we kind of on the law and stuff like that, maybe, and the Exodus. Temple, yeah. Any other biggies that we ought to have on there that we haven't got in there at the moment? Well, it's the Bible. The Bible. Jesus, let's make sure it gets in there, I think. Okay, Jesus. The exile, yep. Church. Okay, there's some stuff, okay? All right. Those are the sort of things that we find in the Bible, big themes, big events that we take place in the Bible. And, you know, we've just been doing a course here, haven't we? The God's Big Picture course. And when you read through the Bible through a kind of Christian lens, you're looking at those things, aren't you? You're looking at kind of the fall, the importance of that. You're looking at the covenant. We didn't mention that, really, did we? About Abraham, you know, the covenant he had. But that's very important, isn't it? We also looked at the law, which you mentioned there. And, of course, Jesus, the cross. I mean, that's why I read you. That was kind of, there was a clue in the reading, you know. The cross, you know, that's kind of quite a really reasonably important event. So there we have sort of some of the main things that we think of as Christians. But if you were talking to perhaps a secular historian and you were saying to them, right, here I've got this book which covers this period in history, and not just this period in history, but also this particular part of the world during this period in history, which is what the Bible does. It concentrates on one part of the world and certain events that take place over a broad bit of history, yes? They'd say to you, I think the really big story is not kind of the fall, the Exodus, the exile, these sort of things. That's probably not their big perspective. They'd say, what we're seeing through this period and in this part of the world is a transition from the late Stone Age with all its very particular material culture into the early Bronze Age, and the development for the first time of societies away from small tribal groups into kind of the first kingdoms, regional power bases with greater sort of material capacities and communication, broadening out of trade. And then eventually through the course of this period we hit the early sort of the latter Bronze Age, where it's much more sophisticated, the development of writing is taking place, and then we go bang into the Iron Age and everything takes off. And for the first time the practical wherewithal to develop not just kingdoms but kind of empires takes off, and suddenly you can have kind of superpowers and infrastructure and bureaucracy, and writing becomes much more fluent, and they have plows and agriculture and great you know, military machines and so on. That's the big story in the Middle East during the period of this of that the Bible covers. That's, they would say, is probably the big story. So in one sense, when you look at the stories that the Bible has to tell and you set them against the kind of the big events that are going on sort of from a history point of view around there, a lot of our story seem like quite small events against the big historical backdrop. So, for example, like Abraham. Take somebody like Abraham. He is cutting a covenant with God. But where is he? He's on a mountain somewhere, in a relative backwater. He's on his own at night. There's not many really witnesses around. And to all intents and purposes, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, it's not like a massive earthquake, is it? It's not shaking the world. So there are big things going on in the world, and Abraham's, it's really quite a small private matter apparently going on. Anybody like to hazard a guess roughly when Abraham's cutting his covenant, roughly historically? Just a guess. 1800 to 2000 BC. Okay, roughly around that sort of time. If you go to the historians again and you say, well, what's going on? Really, what's the big picture in the world? As far as we can say, if there was a British historian and they wanted to talk about what's going on in Britain in about that same time. So Abraham's on the mountain cutting a covenant with God. What's going on in Britain? They've just finished Stonehenge. Okay? Which they're quite pleased with, I should imagine. Right? Tourists still come from all over the world to have a look. Wasn't too bad. So I think from a British point of view, that's the big story. Right? You know, the ancient Britons. If you went to the sort of the Mediterranean around that sort of thing, you know, Minoans, the Crete, the city of Knossos, this fabulous palace was being built there. And because for the very first time, a proper seafaring network was taking place around the Mediterranean, and people were bringing goods from Egypt up to Greece, and they were ferrying it around. And for the first time, this extraordinary concentration of wealth and produce around in the center of the Mediterranean. If you were an Egyptologist, you'd be saying, well, during that period, there was a civil war in Egypt. The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom were at war with each other. It was a cataclysmic event out of which a new kingdom eventually formed. And if you're a student of the Mesopotamian Valley, you'd say the Ur of Chaldea, which was the principal city in the world at that time, was overrun by the Amorites. And the great civilization that had flourished there came to a grinding halt as it was overtaken by barbarians. Now, what we hear about is a guy on a mountain having a private kind of interaction with the living God. But in the world, there are these sort of, I suppose, from a historical point of view, what were seen as the big stories, the big events taking place. I mean, Abraham was in Ur and left. You know, you can see that those big events are affecting him, but it's not, that's not the story the Bible is telling us. Or also, probably the most important, according to my judgment anyway, about that same time, is for the first time people started to domesticate horses around 2000 BC. So instead of hunting and eating them, they actually started to capture them and use them to plow, use them to pull chariots, pull goods, ride them into war. And that had a massive transformative effect. I mean, that is the beginning. I mean, like, we get excited about emails. You used to be able to send a letter and it would get there tomorrow. Now you can send a message and it gets there basically almost as you send it. How did that happen? Amazing. And being able to take a message by horseback compared to having to run or to walk had a radicalizing effect on communications. There was a communications revolution was taking place when the horse was eventually domesticated. Interestingly, when you read the Bible, if we're saying that the horse was domesticated around about the time of Abraham, it's interesting to notice that there's no mention of a horse in the whole book of Genesis, all the way through the book of Genesis, up until just about 100, 150 years after Abraham. And you can see for the first time the trickle effect of the domestication of horses is actually finding its way into the pages of the Bible. Chapter 47, verse 17 of Genesis, in Joseph, there's a written account that they gave water to their horses. First mention of the Bible, as you can see, it actually chimes in with a historical record of when horses domesticated. Within 100, 150 years, they're showing up in the scriptures, which is fascinating to see, and it's very confirming of the historicity of it all. But here's the point I'm making. The Bible's not a general history book. If you're looking for a history of the world, an encyclopedic history of the world, this, and I'm going to call it something which we don't usually call it, this little book, and it is a relative little book. People are always saying, I know it's a big book, as if somehow reading a book which has got, like, you know, 600 or 700 pages is some impossible feat for man to accomplish. We tend to sort of talk about it as this great big book. But actually, really, when you think about the scope and the scale of what is the ambition of the book, to talk about the whole of life, the universe and everything, the meaning of life and all that's in it, from the beginning right down to some as yet arrived at place in the future, I mean, really, it's a pretty thin volume, isn't it, when you think about it like this. But it's not an encyclopedic history book. It's not even an encyclopedic history book of kind of all of theology, everybody's thoughts and beliefs about God. It's very, very much more narrow than that, isn't it? It's very specific about what really is seeking to achieve. Now, there are times Abraham was focusing on and saying, here's a little guy, history's carrying on out there, God's doing something under the radar, as it were. But there are times, I don't know if you can think of an example, I've got one here, where the big events of history and the big events of the Bible and its theology collide. The example I was thinking of was the destruction of Jerusalem, for example. 586 BC, the Babylonians overthrow the city of Jerusalem. From a historical point of view, what you're seeing is you're seeing the end of the Bronze Age with their kingdoms. And then the Iron Age civilizations like the Babylonians who are emerging in all their new might are swallowing up all these little kingdoms one by one. There's a kind of a technological, civilizational growth spurt taking place. And all this, the old world is being swallowed by the new world bit by bit. And we see the kingdom of Judah being swallowed whole by the empire of the Babylonians in one mouthful, really. So that's the way historians would say, here comes the Iron Age in all its muscle to swallow up the Bronze Age. But we see it, we see the destruction of Jerusalem as the ultimate curse of the law eventually falling upon those who fail to keep the law that God had given for the governance of his kingdom. And God warns them again and again by his prophets, and eventually the unforeseen circumstances, the things they couldn't even imagine, like the rise of the Iron Age. I mean, if you're a Bronze Age man, you cannot envisage any more than you can envisage what the great next technological phase of humanity will be. it just kind of comes along. But God said, if you live like this, you'll be all right, whatever changes take place. And they ignore God, they do it their own way, and they're taken out. So it's, the curse comes upon them. So we see it as a theological thing. They didn't obey God, and this was the consequences. So sometimes these two things kind of come together. Are we all right with that so far? Okay. The scope of the Bible is basically dealing with a time period of over 4,000 years. It's only a little book, right? That's an ambitious project, isn't it? I'm going to tell you a very specific set of events that span 4,000 years. And we're going to get it in a little volume that you can pick up and carry around under your arm. That's amazing, isn't it, really? And it's ambition. 4,000 years of human history. And you know that if there's 4,000 years of history in there, there's going to be a ton of stuff that you're going to think should be or could be in there that's not in there, right? Because it just simply will not fit unless you're just going to give one line to each particular subject. You're going to have some distinctions between them. Anybody want to tell me when the Bible first started to be written? Because you know it's written by numerous different writers over a longer period of time. Does anybody want to say who started first putting pen to paper, as it were? Probably wasn't pen to paper, was it? It was chisel to stone, or... Yeah, do you want to give us a date, roughly? Roughly how long ago? 3,500 BC, says Sean. I'd go for more like 1,500 BC. So about 3,500 years ago, 3,400 years ago, Moses starts writing the Bible. Okay? And roughly speaking, so if we've got here, this is sort of, you know, I'm going to write a book. Starts writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, let's be clear. 3,500, 400 years ago. Roughly speaking, he didn't finish it himself because he died and he had to hand on baton, somebody else who carried on writing it until eventually the last... Oh, there's a lot of blank pages at the back, as if they want me to write, so I'm not going to. It's finished. The book is finished. Book of Revelation, signed off by John, roughly when? 90? Yes? Yeah. I'd go for 70 myself, but broadly, we're not going to fall out in over 20 years, are we? Really? Essentially speaking, what we're saying is, here's a book that was written probably from about 1,500 BC to about 70 to 90 AD. So we've got a period of about maybe 1,500 years in the writing, covering a subject which is over 4,000 years worth of material. It's a massively ambitious project, isn't it? I suppose the good news is, in a way, is that out of this period of time, there's two blocks of writing here, two blocks of history that the Bible writers write nothing about. They're not interested in at all. The period between Joseph and Moses, 400 years, not a line, it seems, to cover that subject, as if it just didn't happen, it's not important, skipped over, just dropped 400 years. That certainly helps. And then also the period between sort of Ezra and the Second Temple and then the birth of Jesus Christ, another 400 years, interestingly, nothing about it, nobody did any writing through that period at all. So you're losing 800 years out of the mix, but that still says that the writers, while they were writing, were continually writing about events both in their past and in their presence, and they saw coming in the future for a continual period of 800 years. 800 years. That means, imagine if you go back to the 12th century in this country, the medieval period in this country, and you imagine sort of trying to bring together manuscripts that have been accumulated over the last 800 years that give you a kind of a cogent history over the last 800 years. I mean, just think of the sort of things we'd have to put into a British history account. You'd be putting in there, you'd imagine it's going to be a pretty book. You've got to start with a Magna Carta, and you've got to have discovery of trade with China. You've got to have Geoffrey Chaucer in the medieval system, you've got to have the advent of the printing press, and then you've got to move on to the discovery of America, and then you've got the Renaissance and its effect on culture, and Copernicus and the development in science, and the overthrow of the medieval system of thinking, and the destruction and of the monasteries, and Henry VIII, and then you've got the Reformation and Shakespeare, and then we've got Galileo and Cromwell, and we've only just dealt with the first 300 or 400 years. I mean, imagine trying to put that together. It's going to be a huge book, isn't it? And that's just our little island. And when you get in this book, you're not going to get, if you're looking for how did they build the pyramids? People always want to know, how did they build the pyramids? It doesn't even mention the pyramids. Everybody says it's the biggest thing in the whole wide world, right? Huh? Straw and bricks. Well, they're made of stone, but there's nothing. It's as if the pyramids didn't exist. There's no room in the Bible for the pyramids. There's no room in the Bible for China or India, really. There's no room in the Bible for the Greek civilization, actually. There's a few mentions at the beginning, but it's as if it didn't exist. We all think it's frightfully important, but the Bible hardly even gives it a nod. And as for Europe, and let alone Britain, I mean, it's just like, whew, forget it. Forget it. It's not even on the radar. So there's a lot of stuff isn't in the Bible. This is my introduction. I'll get onto this bit in a minute. But it's amazing, even in this little book, you do get the rise of empires, don't you? You've got the Sumerians, you get the Egyptians, you get the sea peoples, like the Philistines. You've got the Hittites. They're the people who first domesticated the horses and rode out for the world's first cavalry. The world didn't know what hit them. They just swept across the Middle East, conquered Egypt. These hill people from the north of Turkey. The Phoenicians and their trading empires around the whole of the Mediterranean. And then you get in here the Greeks, to some extent, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Romans, and even a couple of mentions to the Gauls. So it's amazing how much you do get in here, considering it's such a small book. Last two things to say, really, before I just show you some slides, is this. We said quite a lot about these kind of developments from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age to the Iron Age and the way they kind of surface. It's interesting, at the cusp point between the end of the Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age, as trade and prosperity is flourishing in unprecedented ways, when you look at the bits of the Bible that were written around about that time, and you look at the vocabulary that is used in those portions of Scripture, they are complex, rich, shot through with a massively wide vocabulary. There are words.